Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome into a very joyless edition of the Celtics Lab podcast. I'm sorry I had to be the first appearance of our guest, Barry Ebru of Pro Fan Sports Podcast. He's on here to give us the fan reaction. We're going to do a fan-based perspective podcast. Pretty good. You should check it out. But this was really not the episode to maybe, you know, start things off on a series on a good foot. We're here with Alex Goldberg. Cam Tabatabai will be joining us later. I'll be hosting for now. Let's just dive right into this loss. It was not what we were expecting to see, but also what we were expecting to see. Alex, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's obviously extremely disappointing for the Celtics to start off a series at home without Joel Embiid and come up empty-handed. James Harden was exceptional, I think, is the first story of the game that we have to talk, you know, 45 points, vintage MVP level form, making plays for others, consistently stepping up when the Sixers needed him to. So the big story is just that James Harden was exceptional, and this is now a different series with that James Harden out there. I mean, we'll see if he's able to replicate this effort over the course of multiple games, but he was great tonight, and the Celtics did a pretty poor job adjusting on the defensive end to try and contain him. I think those are the two kind of headliner stories. Obviously, there were some fourth quarter execution woes with the offense as well. We'll get into that a little bit more explicitly later in the pod. But yeah, the big headline, Harden great, Celtics defense falters, and the fourth quarter was a mess from an offensive execution standpoint. And that's how you lose basketball games in the playoffs.
Yeah, so the defensive adjustment that you referenced, the lack of defensive adjustments, that was particularly concerning. It was really the tail of the game, in my opinion. There were some other people pushing back on that, but Barry, what did you see with regard to defense in this game?
With the Celtics defense, I don't know, I just saw, I didn't see that same, you know, energy and that same intensity, you know, that they had in the fourth quarter on defense in game six against the Hawks. You know, they pretty much let James Harden get to his spots, you know, and get where he wanted to on the floor with really no resistance. And, you know, they didn't really adjust. Well, they tried to adjust to the, you know, pick and roll when they, you know, were switching and stuff, but they were switching to a point where they let James Harden get favorable matchups, in particular with that one against Horford, where he was able to, you know, hit that shot over him, hit the game-winning three, and then also there was some other possessions in which he got a favorable matchup that he was able to take advantage of and exploit. So I, you know, and also I felt like they got to a point where they were paying so much attention to Harden that it opened up other guys, and there are other guys, you know, made shots and made plays, you know, in the fourth quarter and down the stretch. And they were leaving them open, like Tobias Harris was getting open shots. You know, Terrence Maxey was getting, you know, open shots. And those guys made them pay tonight and, you know, and stepped up when they needed to, when, you know, when they got their opportunities once they forced Harden to give up the ball. So it was definitely a really disappointing effort from the Celtics from a defensive standpoint. You know, they definitely could have, you know, played harder on the defensive end. And I feel like that's really where they lost the game, was not able to get stops when they needed to down the stretch.
And Barry, just quickly to your point there, I think part of it is that the Sixers play a very different style of basketball when Embiid is not on the floor. This is a team that much more resembled a kind of vintage James Harden Houston Rockets era team with a lot of speed on the wings, undersized in the middle, but with the ability to kind of get into the high screen and roll game and then have cutters rolling to the rim. I mean, you saw that late with Paul Reed getting high picks off and then kind of diving to the rim effectively. And I think the big kind of story for the Celtics on the defensive end is that they really didn't do much to adjust out of their kind of base switch defense. They didn't, for example, like one counter that I was thinking of as that game was going on is maybe you play Marcus Smart off the ball, have him guard PJ Tucker so that when you bring PJ Tucker into that switching action, Marcus is there to get in front of James Harden. I think Robert Williams, for example, actually made a pretty significant presence and impact on the game. And I was a little bit upset to see him not play late and Malcolm Brogdon playing instead. I get why Malcolm Brogdon, I think, had a pretty nice offensive game for the most part, but the Celtics were small and the Sixers' size and speed, or sorry, not size, but the Sixers' speed on offense was able to kind of take advantage of that in the high screen and roll game. And there really wasn't much adjustment by Joe Mazzulla or his staff to counter that.
Yeah, one of the
Well,
big.
quick point.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, just a quick point before you go. Just was that what another thing that I picked up on notice was that even when so they would set one ball screen and then like a guard like Smart or somebody who's a really good defensive guard would be on there. So then what they would do is they'd set another ball screen and then a big would have to step up and go to Harden. So I felt like they kind of countered that switching defense by with the Celtics by setting multiple high ball screens. So there was sometimes it was various players. It was PJ Tucker. Sometimes it'd be Paul Reed. Sometimes it'd be Tobias Harris. Like there were it was different guys that were setting that ball screen. It was just wasn't one ball screen. It was like two or three before Harden even got to make the move to drive to the basket or he went to his step back on three that he was able to hit tonight with consistency. So I feel like Billy did a good job in terms of being able to really put pressure on that Celtics defense and and really take advantage of their switching defense and and pretty much make them pay for for those multiple switches that they were doing.
Also, the Celtics really failed to take advantage of their size in this matchup. They let the Sixers dictate the pace of the game. And normally, fast is what the Celtics want to play. They actually could have benefited from slowing it down and taking it into the paint like they did in the first half. They did so much better in the paint to start the game and then just went away with that. And I think, Alex, to your point about not playing Time Lord in the second half as much. I think that was really one of the main weaknesses that you can point to that Joe really did not address in the second half.
Yeah, no, I think size was definitely something that the Celtics played to their advantage in numerous instances, in particularly the second quarter when they went on a kind of nice run prior to the Sixers cutting it back towards the end of the half. They started to really assert their will with that double big lineup. And in particular, Tatum was really doing a nice job kind of applying physical presence and getting into the paint, and I think there were those opportunities late. It's Marcus Smart was able to score in the paint. Al Horford was able to score in the paint late. It's not like they completely went away from that. I think the big thing is that they slowed down a lot to get into their offense. As you mentioned before, the pace was way off. And I think there is something to the idea that they could have slowed down at different points in the game to try and just establish like a post position or a post play. But in particular, where they got killed for slowing down was late in the game, in the kind of last 3 2 minutes of the game when a lot of their set plays really took, you know, it's taking like 7-8 seconds just to get into the action. And I think the play that you most see that on is that really brutal turnover to give the Sixers a 1-point lead. You know, that play took 7-8 seconds just to get going. And I think the Celtics got themselves in a position where, like, suddenly there's 3 seconds left. Malcolm Brogdon has a guy on him and doesn't have a clear path to a shot. I just feel like they've been doing this thing all postseason and really for in the regular season too, where when the game gets close, they do slow down, but not in a way that's effective. They slow down in a way where they're burning clock and then getting into their sets and actions late. You want to get into the set early, even if you use the whole shot clock, even if you use the full 24 seconds, which I think is an understandable prerogative in late game offense. You got to get into the action early and move the defense around a little bit, make dudes rotate, make dudes adjust. Otherwise, you're just wasting time giving the defense a chance to catch their breath and set themselves. And in general, the process, I think, on offense really was not good late. I also think that part of it is that this Celtics team, when they start missing shots, they start playing worse defense. And I hate to use terms that cliche, but in this case, it's pretty true. And so when they started kind of missing shots, particularly on the perimeter, you start to see things like Tyrese Maxey getting leakouts. You start to see things like, you know, the Celtics having to struggle to get back in transition. And given the kind of smaller offense heavy lineups that they were playing with Horford at the five, with Brogdon at the two, in general, that's just not a recipe for winning late, particularly when James Harden is shooting at the level that he was.
Yeah, there seems to be this desire to get into that whole prevent offense thing that they do late in games. Even when they had like a 4-point lead, it looked like they were trying to run clock down. It was just a very weird performance from the team in general. Rather than taking a play-by-play recap of the fourth quarter, let's try to take a bigger view. What are our thoughts overall on how the Celtics can improve in game two and address this? Barry, you get us going first. What can we do?
I think execute better offensively. I think the first half was pretty good, you know, in terms of, you know, being able to, you know, move the ball, not turn it over, you know, being aggressive and attacking the paint and being able to finish strong once they get into the paint. I think just being able to consistently do that for a full 48 minutes, you know, is definitely what is something that they want to do and want to address, you know, come game two. And I certainly think that, you know, they will make that adjustment. With Tatum and Brown, just making sure those two guys are, I mean, Tatum was really good up until the end. Brown was in the second half really a non-factor and, you know, turning it over and not, you know, taking good shots and stuff. So I think, you know, making sure that you get him more involved and stuff, but like they kind of went away from him in the second half. So I think that's something they need to do.
They could get involved with other players as well too, because I mean, there was really only three players in this entire game on the Boston side of things that had any kind of an offensive impact or really even touched the ball more than like maybe one play at a time for really long stretches. Alex, what do you suggest?
Play Grant Williams more. I think that he has a place in this series, particularly as a perimeter defender. He's a guy who I actually feel pretty comfortable with in the switching actions. I think, you know, he's going to have his struggles. He's going to struggle with size. And if he's not hitting shots, that's going to be difficult for him to see minutes. But purely on the defensive end, I do think Grant could make an impact. I think Robert Williams also needs to play a little bit more. I think the big thing is this, that they need to really address how they're going to defend in the high screen and roll. when Harden and Maxey are hunting Horford and hunting Jaylen Brown in particular. Our friend of the pod, Yahya Dubin, just posted this on Twitter that James Harden, when running pick and roll at Horford tonight, 16 direct picks for 28 points at a 1.75 points per possession pace from second spectrum. That's unacceptable. Like, the Celtics cannot win if Al Horford is just getting destroyed on screen and rolls with James Harden. I think maybe potentially going back to a drop-based defense and then having Marcus Smart start plays guarding PJ Tucker so that when they bring PJ Tucker into the screening action, he's the guy who's getting in front of James Harden. I think another thing is that Derek White had a pretty bad offensive performance tonight. He needs to hit shots and make teams feel him a little bit more on the offensive end. They've come to rely on him a lot. And, you know, it's one of those things where he needs to be able to score effectively so that he can defend late. And Joe Mazzulla doesn't have to go to Brogdon late, who I think we agree is a pretty superb scorer and had a really nice game tonight from an offensive standpoint. But Brogdon is also a huge target on the defensive end for just about any opposing defense. I think the simple solution is it starts on the defensive end. They have to stay more engaged. They have to do a better job navigating high screen and roll actions. And obviously, they have to be aware of the potential for the floor geography to change when Joel Embiid comes back. We'll see what he looks like. And so it's hard for me to kind of make a lot of future predictions about the series based off of this game, just because the Sixers are a completely different team when Embiid is out there in a lot of respects. And in some ways, they are more difficult to play. In some ways, they don't play with the same pace. They don't play with the same speed. I think that could be something where the Celtics could find some advantages. The question is, will they actually exploit them and take advantage of them?
Well, I do think that your point about the changing ground is important, both in the fact, as you noted, that they do need to be a little bit more flexible with the team that they have in terms of how they are playing the team that's in front of them. But also, as you noted, they might not be playing the same style of play if Joel Embiid is back. They almost certainly won't, but maybe they should. I know we've been arguing about whether or not the Sixers should be changing up how they play, given how well Maxey plays with the running game and kind of complements Harden. But it is pretty hard to take somebody that new in their career and convince the entire team to change how they play when you have an MVP candidate and a top 20-ish, I'm being generous here, what we saw tonight anyway, player in James Harden. Barry, I know we have to get you out of here, but any closing thoughts before we let you go on what you saw and what you hope to see?
Yeah, I think, you know, just hope to see, you know, better execution, you know, less turnovers, you know, down the stretch, and just better, you know, play with better pace. I mean, you know, Alex said it, they slowed down too much. They, you know, kind of tried to run clock and they got off their game when, once they tried to do that and got into their plays, you know, way too late. And really kind of, you know, had to rush in order to get a shot off. And that certainly came to, you know, back to bite them, you know, towards the end of the game. So just playing with pace consistently, you know, getting into the paint, you know, continue to, you know, attack inside where they have that advantage, as we saw in the first half, or really all night. So just continue to stay, you know, with that as far as, you know, getting downhill and, and I think just playing harder with more energy and intensity on defense, you know, multiple efforts, being more active on that end of the floor. Definitely would like to see more, you know, like I said, more Grant and Rob in there, you know, for defensive purposes, and less Sam Hauser. And then I think this is a series where it's not a good matchup for him. So I certainly think that, you know, when you have those guys in there, if they, you know, do end up, you know, doing that high screen and roll, Those guys are better at being able to guard those switches. If you do stay with the switching defense, then as opposed to Horford and other guys that they had on the floor tonight. So I think if they can do that for game two, I think this team, you know, should be fine and should be able to bounce back and, you know, and win game two and even up this series going into Philadelphia for game three on Friday.
Any change in prediction for how the series is going to go?
I still think the Celtics will win. I think they'll end up winning in six. I'll go Celtics in six. So, yes, you know, I still feel confident, feel good about their chances of winning this series, even, you know, despite of what happened tonight. And even with this tough loss that they had, but I think they'll make the right adjustments and, you know, certainly be more focused and locked in game two and certainly, you know, do a better job of playing the full 48 minutes and executing on both ends of the floor, you know, in crunch time.
All right, man. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you guys for having
me. Where can our guests find you?
So you can find us on YouTube, Broke In Sports Podcast. We, you know, release episodes every week, you know, with guests on there. We just recently had our good friend, Dr. Justin Quinn on there a couple weeks ago. So that was certainly a great episode. So definitely check that out on YouTube. We're on all social media platforms, on Facebook. You know, Broke In Sports, and yeah, just type that in on there on Facebook and you'll find us on there. On Instagram, Broke_In_Sports, you'll be able to find our Instagram page through that handle, and then also you'll find us on Twitter at, you know, Broke In Sports as well. So you can follow us on all social media platforms and, you know, check out our content on there where we post new content weekly. And yeah, and we have, you know, great guests on there as well. So I appreciate the support and I appreciate you guys having me on the show tonight. It was definitely fun and a blast being on there.
Circumstances.
Yeah, for sure. I hear you. I was sure too, but hopefully the next time I'm back on, if you guys have me back, you'll hopefully it'll be much better circumstances at that time.
Indeed. Take care, man.
Thank you guys. Appreciate it. Have a good night.
Justin, if you were a betting man, how many games do you think the Celtics will need to win the series on?
So I baked in two losses. I'm still going with Celtics in six, same with Barry. But I'm a little more nervous now. I would want to hedge my bet a little bit. Where might I do such a thing if I were a bet?
Well, if you were to hedge your bet after this performance by James Harden and this not so great effort by the Celtics, one place you could hedge your bet is on FanDuel. Make a fast break to FanDuel to hedge your bets or to place your bets during the NBA playoffs, because right now, new customers can get a no-sweat first bet up to $1,000. That's $1,000 back in bonus bets if your first bet doesn't win. There's no better place to bet all the playoff action than America's number one sportsbook. Visit FanDuel.com/Boston and get a no-sweat first bet up to $1,000. That's FanDuel.com/Boston. FanDuel, the official sports betting partner of the NBA. 21 plus in select states. First online real money wager only. $10 deposit required. Refund issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 14 days. Restrictions apply. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. FanDuel is offering online sports wagering in Kansas under an agreement with Kansas Star Casino, LLC. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit FanDuel.com/RG. Colorado, Iowa, Michigan, New Jersey, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Tennessee, or Virginia. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP or text NEXT-STEP to 53342. Arizona, 1-888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org/chat in Connecticut, 1-800-9-WITH-IT Indiana, 1-800-522-4700 or visit ksgamblinghelp.com for Kansas, and then 1-877-770-STOP-LA, gamblinghelplinema.org, or call 800-327-5050 for 24/7 support in Massachusetts. Visit mdgamblinghelp.org in Maryland, 1-877-8-HOPE-NY, or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York, 1-800-522-4700 in Wyoming, or visit 1-800-GAMBLER.net in West Virginia. And Justin, if you are like me and not feeling super great after a loss like this, and perhaps you've done things such as tie your mental health to the success or lack thereof of a certain basketball team clad in green, one thing that you could do if you're feeling like I'm feeling is go to BetterHelp. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. And, you know, I think that it's probably not the wisest choice to tie my mental health to my basketball team. In general, it's typically worked out pretty poorly for me, even if the highs are very high. If the lows are low, then you might want to consider checking in with BetterHelp. You can get to know yourself, which is a challenging and difficult process, particularly if, again, you have a toxic relationship to a basketball team like myself. But in general, one of the things that you can do with BetterHelp is start to gain some self-awareness and understanding with regard to yourself and your relationship to your basketball team. Sometimes we don't really know what we want or why we react the way that we do until we talk through things. And BetterHelp connects you with a licensed therapist who can take you on that journey of self-discovery from wherever you are. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Discover your potential with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/celtlab, that's C-E-L-T-L-A-B, today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp, H-E-L-P.com/celtlab.
So this is a little bit of news that we could talk about that maybe will put us in a bit of a better mood, but there's also some news that will put us in a predictably irritable mood that involves the FBI. We won't dwell too long on any of this stuff. It's late, and frankly speaking, I want to memory wipe this from my brain as fast as possible. But the Celtics are in, you know, typical preparation for the NBA draft, working out some prospects. A couple of second round projected guys, University of Kentucky's, I'm going to murder his name, so apologies in advance, Oscar Tshiebwe.
I believe that's right.
Oh, nice. Very cool. He's the 2022 National College Player of the Year. He's 6'9" with a 7'4" wingspan. Think kind of like a mini Rob that was a little bit less skilled, but he is pretty likely to return to UK with the hopes of improving his draft stock, which I think he probably could. So unless he gets a promise, he's not going to end up, I think, getting drafted this year. Also, they worked out Cincinnati wing Landers Nolly II, 6'7", 3-and-D archetype, shot 41.7% from three. As a senior, that was his sole season on volume and on accuracy, so it might be a work in progress. A full college season is really not a big enough sample size, but it's pretty promising. He's also a pretty good defender. Anyone you're looking at in the second round, maybe, that you can think of off the top of your head?
Jeez, the second round of the NBA draft is not something I've even remotely thought about with any sort of recency. I mean, my default is to go with the Brad Stevens strategy of trade the pick for a player who can help you win now. I realize that that is cost complicated for sure, but nobody really jumps off the page. I mean, the second round is a complete crapshoot. You just got to go best player available and see what happens.
Yeah, you aren't wrong. The Celtics will... depending on how the draft lottery later on this month ends up shaking out, either end up with the 32 pick that would be owed to them by the Houston Rockets. If they get very lucky, if they don't get quote-unquote lucky, they'll still get the 35th pick with the only pick that they'll have possessed from the Portland Trailblazers. So you can get a pretty decent guy who might be able to play now. And that seems to fit the profile of the guys they're looking at. Some people I've been thinking about as a UConn homer, I would love to see Adama Sanogo. He is also 6'9", but he can block some serious shots. I can shoot the three ball okay, well enough where I think it might go in at a slightly better than Jared Sullinger level at the next level. Plays a position of potential need. Purdue's Zach Edey is 7'4", an absolute mountain of human being, but has some pretty mobile feet for the size. Could be interesting as well if he stays in the draft. And then the Zags, Drew Timmy is a good potential situational big I'd keep an eye on for Boston as well if they do end up using the pick. But as you suggested, there's a pretty good chance they might not. Now, speaking of investigations, it was revealed by the Boston Herald, who got some Freedom of Information access to some pretty old but significant FBI files, that said that one Bill Russell was currently being faded across the NBA with six patches, banners, and floor paintings and everything else you can imagine. He was surveilled like Martin Luther King was by the FBI and the Civil Rights era, who were very, very convinced that the Black Panther Party, who, like Bill Russell, hailed from Oakland, California, might have some connections to communist subversives. They even tried to nail him for gambling after going all the way back to his youth in Louisiana, but didn't find anything that they could do that was actionable. Thoughts on the FBI being very FBI-ish, Alex?
J. Edgar Hoover is one of the darkest figures in the history of the United States, and his legacy will leave a lasting impact that will affect generations of Black Americans. I don't know.
About sums it up.
That's all I got.
Yeah. And apart from that, we will get this segment done with Maine Celtics head coach Alex Barlow going back to Butler, where he was a player under Brad Stevens, to be an assistant coach under the current head coach, Tad Mata. He was hired by Brad as a video coordinator in 2015, worked his way up through the organization as a player development coach. I believe he worked with Time Lord mostly early on, and then started working with what was then the Maine Red Claws, eventually becoming their head coach after being an affiliate assistant head coach, I think it was. And now he's gone. So we're going to see some pretty significant turnover across the Celtics organization over this summer between what was taken from the Celtics organization assistant coaching bench with the departure of Ime Udoka, through all of that fun stuff, and the other coaches who left, like Will Hardy, most recently Damon Stoudemire of Georgia Tech. Any thoughts on that before we let you go?
Steven Silas, come on down. There are vacancies open, and we'd love to have you.
Oh, yes. Speaking of Oakland Zone. All right, through the magic of editing, when we talk again, we will be here with Cam, and Alex will be sleeping like an angel, I hope.
Surely. Thanks, Justin.
Anytime. And we are back with, through the magic of editing, as aforementioned, with Cameron Tabatabai live from the Garden. Normally, this would be a much more exciting moment, but as we know, the Celtics dropped game one. Before the game, we shared some comments online about it being a trap game. How do you feel about being right?
It's funny. I forgot about that commentary until just now. I feel bad about it because it just played out in slow motion, that the Celtics were just so unwilling to make changes on how they guarded James Harden. Occasionally they double teamed him, which Joe Mazzulla and Malcolm Brogdon both said was categorically the wrong call after the game, which I guess, I mean, the proof is in the pudding. Harden, it went for 45. Everything was the wrong call, apparently. So it just felt, I felt like it was a trap game from afar, because that's what trap games look like. Star players are out and teams have different amounts of rest and whatnot. Watching it, it wasn't a trap. It was like the Celtics made a trap and then they got in it, closed the lid on themselves.
What else did they ever do?
Yeah, I saw this from ESPN Stats and Info, and I don't have it in front of me, but this was the ninth time Boston was favored by double digits and blew the lead, which would be the most since, I think, the 1990-91 season.
So
that's not good.
Yeah, defense was definitely one of the things we talked about in the first half while you were doing your media. Another thing that we talked about was how they went away from using their size advantage to attack in the paint in the second half. Did you hear anything about that?
Not explicitly, but I definitely observed that insofar as I thought Robert Williams was really effective. The beginning of the fourth quarter, I mean, he was good in the third quarter, but the beginning of the fourth quarter, he and Brogdon in particular they had it going on. I don't think Brogdon can play without double bigs behind him. I think he's too much of a liability on defense is really my rapid reaction to that, which doesn't quite answer the Celtics didn't go big. Early, Jaylen Brown was really attacking the rim, but once he lost his handle, he had, I think, four turnovers or something like that. He never got back into the groove, and he was the one who was really attacking the rim. Tatum was a little bit, but it wasn't as strong a point of emphasis. Boston ended with 66 points in the paint, but that wasn't the story here, and so that wasn't the story in the press room. The story here was Boston had 16 turnovers, and James Harden went for 45, and James Harden is a very good player, a former MVP. It's not like they handed him 45 points, but they really did not have the defensive juice to slow him down. So I do agree that the relaxing Boston's pressure on the inside was an interesting choice, but it wasn't talked about post-game because the story, either understandably or not, was turnovers and defense.
That's a fair read, too. Specifically about who did you talk to and what were some of the dominant paradigms besides turnovers and the lack of defense or poor defense, I should say?
Sure. So Mazzulla was very numbers focused. In losses, he is often really detail oriented. I think that's how his mind works, but I think that's also a way to not really talk about big picture themes. And you know, it's interesting. So Tatum, Jay King asked him, hey, you guys are ranked 11th in defense. And he said, yeah, that's on us. But, you know, the stats, the statistical significance of these stats in the playoffs are not that rich. So, like, let's be careful with making sweeping assumptions about statistics. So I do find when Joe, as was the case today, just really dives into the stats, it's not that revealing. He does a good job of taking a question and saying, so for example, he was asked about the double team and he said, look, we double teamed early and they had six quick points off of that. So I wondered from the double team, and he had that answer really quick, which again, it said something about where his mind is at any given time. I mean, I think he thinks, he's obviously a brilliant mind, but the extent to which it's revealing or even personable is limited. And actually, a lot of us were late to Joe Mazzulla's press conference. I think he wanted to go as quick as possible.
And I blame him. No.
No, I don't blame him either. Well, I don't know. I don't know about that, actually. I felt so struck by Doc Rivers pregame. I know that he is a uniquely experienced and charismatic person in the NBA, but there is just something about, to say nothing, he spoke about Heather Walker, a senior VP of Boston's PR team who passed away recently. So Doc knew this person and spoke about her through tears. It was quite moving. And even apropos of that, sorry, I mean, I'm getting choked up thinking about it. It was really quite the moment. But even beyond that, there's just something more familial about his press conferences, and Joe Mazzulla doesn't really offer that. Brogdon was great. Brogdon was really dialed into accountability. He also was really quick to say the double team was the wrong call. And it was interesting. He and Tatum both suggested players made wrong decisions on defense, but obviously no names were named and no one pushed them to name names. I think there were a lot of gambles on defense. Basically, Brogdon was saying, you know, sometimes the coach is called the double team, but other times the double teams just came, suggesting the guys kind of called their own double team number. I thought Marcus Smart had just a Marcus Smart game. I mean, they don't even, they choke the game. I mean, it's not a 119, 115 game if Smart doesn't make some of the plays he makes and some of the defensive plays he makes. He had six turnovers. He was clearly hurt, and he got hit in the chest or the ribs or something. He was clearly not comfortable. So now I'm just kind of rambling. You asked me who I talked to, and I just kind of give you like a scattershot of like different dudes' thoughts.
Yeah, it's good.
Not for nothing. Brown at 23-6-4. He didn't speak at the podium. He spoke in the locker room, which I think players have a little bit of say there. They can't refuse it, but I think Brogdon being the other guy along with Tatum is maybe something to consider.
Yeah, there was a general lack of production up and down the roster besides those three. The lack of adapting to what was in front of them was another issue we talked about in the front half of the podcast. You kind of hinted that they seem to be aware of that with the discussion of the doubling. Was there any other discussion about how they plan to adjust moving forward?
There was mention of adjustments. They didn't say what they would be. All three of them, Tatum, Brogdon, and Mazzulla, all gave the Sixers their flowers as well as they might. I mean, I guess there is an element here that James Harden went dropped 45 on an away court with the presumptive MVP not around. I mean, that's not nothing. Maxey had a number. That was another Mazzulla thing that he just conjured. He's like, well, Maxey had 8 points going to his right, which is something we tried to make him do. So by some regards, you know, the Sixers outplayed Boston's approach. And Boston had some adjustments mid-game, fewer than I think I would have liked to have seen. But Brogdon said something about double team that makes the Celtics get a little frenetic and it creates chaos. So maybe there's kind of an assumption that this group doesn't handle adjustments very well. And actually there's like a little bit of protecting them from themselves. I mean, again, if this team historically costs up leads, then maybe they're not the team that you ask to do this in the second quarter, that in the third quarter, and the third and the fourth. It worked out well. Also, I might have to move my seat in just a moment, just heads up. So the commentary around adjustments were there. They didn't say what it was. It was, yeah, we got to make adjustments, but you know what? This is the NBA guy shoot. Or we got to make adjustments, but you know, James Harden's not going to go for 45 again. So the Celtics rarely tip their hands, certainly in losses. They're not super generous with their X's and O's. So there was not anything super revealing in terms of like, yeah, expect this. Least of which, we don't know what's going to happen if Joel Embiid is on the court, all of the geography changes.
Yeah, all of the classes changes.
It sounds like Doc Rivers said pregame, he has no idea. He very much so is letting the medical staff steer the ship. And he did offer that Joel Embiid did not run and shoot around today being Monday. So I don't know that I think T plays. It was obviously the talk of the town, and Sixers and Celtics writers alike all had wide opinions and were leaning on some reporting and ignoring other reporting. But I'm going to go with the coach saying, I'm not sure, he wasn't running, as a pretty good sign that we're not going to see Embiid, in which case the adjustment has to come around. I think this is one thing Brogdon did offer, is getting more physical with Harden. Uh-huh. Makes sense to me. Marcus was physical with him early, but then Marcus was hurt or something.
He also didn't cover him as much in the second half.
Excuse me. No, he didn't. Yeah, again, I think. So this is how the sausage gets made, is I try to write some things during the game, but obviously if the trend changes, I have to get rid of it. And I had a paragraph on how Brogdon came in and offensively gave the Celtics the stability they needed to not fully let go of the rope. But I don't think he can play defense against a good offensive team, not without quality help. And the help just isn't there when the Celtics play small. So
Grant Williams was mentioned earlier. I think he would be a good pairing for that second unit in particular.
But the problem is then it's like almost political, because it's not the second unit that's the problem. It's because the second unit, if it's Brogdon and Rob Williams, I think there's some mojo there. It's when it's Smart or White, Brogdon, Brown, Tatum at the four, and then Horford. Horford gets stretched because the Sixers are playing small, so he can't rotate down, and either Brogdon is the help or has to rely on help coming. So it's if the Celtics play small, Brogdon can't be in the lineup, I don't think, defensively. And that sucks because his offense and the steadiness of his offense like really mattered at certain times. He's not, you know, Tyler Hero or Kemba Walker. They're not hunting him, but they are aware of his liabilities on defense. Certainly James Harden is.
Well, rather than belabor game one, let's look ahead to game two. Other than the whole Joel Embiid thing, which personally I think they're going to rest him, because until the adjustment that the Celtics make works, they've got a winning formula, right? Might as well try it out one more time, see if it works. Anything else to watch for in game two that you can think of off the top of your head?
Yeah, we got to start doing podcasts at the TD Garden. I look great in this light.
You do look pretty nice. Sue helps.
I look, yeah. Well, I was sitting three seats back before and I had a double chin. I have a good setup here. It's funny. This is not the question that you asked, but I get in the press game or the post game, you always see the players and they just turn it off. The players are always looking at the score sheet and sometimes they're distracted. And I find myself keep looking at the stats. I guess because they're interesting, but they just turn it off on me. So never mind. If Boston can't adjust, book those Cancun tickets, right? The defense, Harden was really good, but the defense it never felt like Boston had its footing on defense. He wasn't like turning them into fools. I mean, he had some shots that were over really good defense. Maxey had some great shots. Melton got hot for a little bit. Tobias Harris had a really efficient game. The Sixers, to their credit, played really well, but they might do it again. And so I think Boston needs to be smarter and tougher and do less on defense. And then I think the offensive stuff, I don't know what could be said to this team just to have them stop turning the ball over at the clip that they do. If I knew, I would
be maybe you wouldn't be doing this.
I wouldn't be doing this. No one seems to know what the right thing to say to this team is to get them to stop with the turnovers, because it was a lot of unforced turnovers, like really consequential unforced turnovers. Philly, it's 20 points off of it. It was just, so I don't know if a Boston team that at least last season cut its teeth on defense and lost their season on turnovers wants to run it back with no defense and more turnovers.
Not a plan for success.
Not a recipe for success. I'm hopeful that that's not the case. The Celtics are the better team, the deeper team. And I think that Joe Mazzulla is a very capable coach. But today, thank goodness this was game one, because this is the kind of game that if it's game five or six, you just mentally collapse. But this is it. This is rock bottom. This is as bad as the Celtics can play. I guess that's not true. They shot like 65. They had an effective field goal percentage of like 65. They shot really well, but the defense and the turnovers, no bueno.
I think it's important for the Celtics to speak of the shirts that you wrote about before the game.
I really want one.
No, they're good, right? Great for pun fans like ourselves. The point of them, the intensity, they need to bring finals level intensity to this game, because for all they know, this might be the toughest series they face if they do get past it, right? Miami can give them a similar level of intensity that we have seen dethrone, you know, higher seeded teams in the Milwaukee Bucks. But by the time they get through the New York Knicks, I mean, Jimmy Butler is already dealing with a sprained ankle.
Yeah.
They need to treat this as if it were the finals, and the next series as if it were the finals, et cetera, et cetera. And that's really the only critique I have of this game, really, is that their defense was pretty good for the most part. It just wasn't good enough. Their offense was very good until it started to be less so. And it was because of laziness, sloppiness, not a lot, but just enough in the context of the stage that they're on.
I mean, look, the Celtics are now 3-2 against the Sixers going back to the regular season, and the two Sixers wins are a 52-point performance from Embiid and a 45-point performance from Harden. So the Sixers are winning with hero ball, but you only have to win four of them.
Yep.
And the Sixers just won maybe the hardest one on the docket. So, Boston's got to tighten up, but also it feels a little unlikely that something this preposterous happens again.
Speaking of other playoff series, the Heat took game one against the Knicks. Are you surprised? And who do you think wins?
I'm selfishly looking at the score of the Suns Nuggets game. Oh, 42-40. Great. I am surprised. No, I'm not. Man, I don't know.
Nothing surprising me from Jimmy Butler and the Heat.
Nothing surprising from Eric Spoelstra and Jimmy Butler and the Heat. I guess whatever I think the Knicks are is still predicated on unproven talent. That the mystique of Tibbs and that garden and the 90s Knicks, if you remove that shine, it's a young team that's probably playing a little bigger than its britches. Whereas the Heat are a team that's been there. They haven't summited the mountain, but they've been on and around the mountain. So it makes sense to me that they wouldn't be flappable in the same way that the Knicks might. Doesn't look good for the Cavs, I'll tell you that much. So I suspect when healthy, the Heat will win because both teams are not the most talented, but what the Heat have as an X factor is not something you can teach or pick up on the fly. The Knicks will win a game or two because Jalen Brunson is really, really good, and if they get Julius Randle back, that changes things big time, but I think it would be quite foolish to root against Jimmy Butler, certainly in these playoffs.
But we don't know if he's even going to play in game two. So that is an X factor to watch. I suspect he's going to because he's Jimmy Butler. Yeah. But I mostly agree with you in that series. Elsewhere, the beam was extinguished. The Warriors sent them home. Thoughts on the series before we talk about who are playing in the second round?
Yeah, I mean, that was the greatest. That was unbelievable. That was this generation's like flu game or something. I mean, that is, it needs a catchy tagline for it, but a 50.
The Bear Poke game?
Well, no, that's, I think of that with the Lakers and the Grizzlies. This was the like, shut the beam down game or de-beam the team. I don't know.
It seems to be a theme, though, like the Warriors were dead and buried and the Lakers were dead and buried and now they're going to play each other.
Yeah, that's kind of fun.
What do you think comes of that?
Here's what I said at dinner today. I think Warriors in five, but emotionally I find myself rooting for the Lakers. I can't come up with a way for the Lakers to even be like particularly competitive. If the Warriors want to blow a game or two, great, but the problem is the Lakers probably need Anthony Davis to be incredible on defense, but is he really also going to bring it on offense? And if he's just bringing it on defense, who the hell is going to score? I don't see the Warriors dynasty losing disassembling because of a 38-year-old LeBron and Rui Hachimura, whereas this Lakers team was average at best and played a Memphis team that was so desperate to go home. I mean, I think chemistry and happiness matter for team success, and the stink around that Grizzlies team, some of it quite serious, and I don't want to belittle, was pungent. I'm not surprised the Lakers pulled that one off. The Kings were a great story, but never underestimate the heart of a champion. So I suppose
you had a point on rooting interest in this, and you know, I reacted with a little bit of camp as to rooting for the Lakers, but frankly speaking, I am too, and not just for my usual reason of wanting to see a Lakers Celtics finals, as absurd and unlikely as that still is for the points you outlined. But I also really don't want to see the Golden State Warriors in the finals, assuming the Celtics can get out of the East semis. It's just...
I think that's the right read for Celtics peeps. For me, it is more... I mean, ostensibly, I write about the Lakers. I write about the Warriors, too. I like the NBA because I like rooting for greatness, and the end is in sight for LeBron in a way that it's not yet for Curry for me. And when push comes to shove, it would just be more spectacular from as a basketball fan to see LeBron do it one more time. And it would be more intriguing as a basketball fan to see what happens if the Warriors don't pull it off. So it might be one of those things. I do this often when I'm reasonably neutral, is I just kind of like see where my emotions are leading me. And by the second or third quarter of a game, I see who I'm rooting for. But then as a Celtics fan, it's tough. I don't have a good answer for that one. I have a Cameron answer, but I don't think I could speak for what Celtics fans are feeling. Probably torn.
Yeah, you kind of want them both to be eliminated, somehow end up with Denver, who I think probably would be the best reasonable matchup for the Celtics at this point that would have a reasonable chance. I don't really think the Lakers have a chance as fun as it would be.
Wait, sorry, can I revisit something?
Yeah, sure.
I said this a moment ago and I didn't really internalize it. It's 42-40 at the half between the Suns and the Nuggets. What? Are they playing without a three-point line? I'm sorry, it's not good podcasting. Denver had 18 points in the first quarter. Yikes.
Yeah, very weird playoffs so far, all around, up and down this season. Let's get out of here on this. What do we want to see above anything else from the Celtics at the start of game two?
I don't care about the start. I care about the second half. I have no qualms with Boston's ability to get out and run, shoot a bunch of threes, get excited. It's when things don't go their way, and they get punched in the jaw a little bit, what do they do? And specifically in the second half of games, I don't have the data in front of me, but anecdotally, I feel like they let themselves linger rather than excel. So sure, it's a home game. Give the fans, put on a show for the fans. But I mean, going back to that Steph game, the only thing that mattered was that third quarter, as is often the case with the Dubs. So I don't care what happens at the beginning of the game. I care what happens in the second half of the game, because the Celtics put on a show in the first half and then they got in their bed and pooped it in the second half. And on that happy note, speaking of which, my computer's literally resting on the hockey boards. Speaking of teams coming up short at TD Garden, there's some symbolism there, I suppose.
Well, that actually bookends everything pretty well that we've been talking about, because for me, what I want to see is a team that acts like what came out of their mouths after the Golden State Warriors beat them on their own home court in game six of the 2022 finals. I want to see a team that remembers what that feels like and plays intelligently and with the heart of a champion to get the banner they deserve but haven't earned.
Yeah, I hope they listen, because they haven't earned it. 16 turnovers is a lot of turnovers. The record for Celtics playoff turnovers, though, is 29 in a game. So it could be worse.
It could be worse. It can always be worse.
Yeah, when I first read that, I was like, well, this is a typo. But nope. All right, well, on that happy note, old Mr. T is going to go to bed and teach. And old Dr. Quinn's got to get up Mr. T's writing.
Well, this episode of the Celtics Lab podcast is brought to you by FanDuel, the exclusive wagering partner of CLNS Media Network and BetterHelp. We all deserve to be happy, even when stuff like this happens.
Adios.